that's why it took longer to discover just how important and influential parts of the petroleum reserve are.
A remote patch of the Arctic is about to get a lot more controversial. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, August 17th. Good evening, I'm Rachel Waldholz. Also tonight, invasive crayfish could pose a threat in Alaska.
So are they eating dead salmon carcasses? Are they eating salmon eggs? Are they just eating insects? We don't know.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Alaska's U.S. senators have issued a second round of statements following the rally of white nationalists last weekend in Charlottesville, Virginia. But this time, their criticisms are aimed at President Trump. Senator Lisa Murkowski posted her remarks on Facebook last night, a day after the president's press conference in Trump Tower. She wrote, quote, "What the president said yesterday was wrong. There is no moral equivalence between those who are inciting hate and division and those who took to the streets to make it clear that those views are unacceptable." Murkowski had previously condemned bigotry and anti-Semitism without mentioning Trump or his assertions that many sides were to blame for the violence. Senator Dan Sullivan's second Facebook post says, quote, "Anything less than complete and unambiguous condemnation of white supremacists, neo-Nazis, and the KKK by the President of the United States is unacceptable. Period." The senators join a number of fellow Republicans in Congress who say the president should have condemned neo-Nazis and white nationalists more forcefully. This morning, Trump issued a series of tweets blasting his critics and lamenting the removal of Confederate statues from American cities. Alaska Congressman Don Young declined to answer a question today in Anchorage during a press conference with other Western state House members.
Congressman, we'd like to hear your thoughts on the events in Charlottesville.
And we're not on that subject right now. We're talking about resources. I brought these people up to see it. They've seen it. Next.
Young's spokesman later provided a written statement that says, "I stand united with Americans from across all corners and demographics of our nation in condemning the violence, hatred, and bigotry in Charlottesville." Details are starting to emerge on the fire at the Peter Pan Seafoods plant in Port Moeller on the Alaska Peninsula. The 100-year-old plant caught fire late Tuesday night and continued to burn Wednesday. The full scope of the damage is still unclear, but witnesses say it is extensive. KDLG's Avery Lill has more.
Theo Chesley of Precision Air flew an aerial survey of the smoldering buildings Wednesday morning.
The main processing facility that is located on the dock, about 40% of the structures on the dock were affected by the fire. Looked like it could have been much worse, but the main generator systems, the cold storage, the refrigeration plant, holding area and office all were devastated by the fire. About 60% of the other structures on the dock facility there that did not burn, however, they could have been affected by the heat. Too early to tell.
Limited power and water have been restored to the plant. Chesley estimated Thursday morning that there were over 100 employees there. He said that the winter generator survived the fire. It's powering the cafeteria, but not much beyond that. Chesley said he and other pilots are coordinating efforts to fly workers out.
So basically, anybody with a pulse and air taxi is trying to help these guys out right now. And of course, the wind is blowing about 35 and visibilities are not that great. So everybody's just trying to do what we can to help these people out because they're a pretty tough situation.
Fisherman Gerald Danielson fought the blaze early Wednesday morning with a group on the beach while boats tackled it from the water. They worked hard for about 2 hours to contain the blaze until the building where the fire began collapsed.
It collapsed in that small area. Couldn't get to that section that was still blazing. Basically, once the wind got to it again, it just spread and we had to basically give up and let it run its course.
No deaths or serious injuries have been reported, and the cause of the fire is still not clear. As of Thursday afternoon, Peter Pan Seafoods has not provided comment. However, Danielson said a representative from the company spoke to the Port Moeller area over VHF radio Wednesday. Danielson also spoke with that representative personally.
They're going to rebuild, and there's new state-of-the-art technology that's available now, and we're going to rebuild with new state-of-the-art technology. This is the plan, is what I was told. You know, this fishery's been around a long time, so I would only hope that they would do that. I'm third-generation fisherman in Port Mueller. You know, it would be devastating if they were just to let this cannery go away and never rebuild.
For this year, Danielson said that for most fishing out of Port Mueller, this signals an abrupt end to the season.
Me personally, there might be a few markets available, but we've had a pretty good season, and I'm probably going to just wrap it up. I think a lot of guys that are duck, same thing. You know, a lot of guys are probably leaning to go home when the weather clears up.
The fire also poses a complication for hauling boats out of the water. A portion of the dock was cut away to contain the fire. Danielson said that some boats that planned on hauling out of the water at Port Mueller may have to go elsewhere. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
The federal government is moving forward with its review of the company Hilcorp's proposal to drill for oil in the Arctic Ocean just off the coast of Alaska. Called the Liberty Project, it would be the first oil production platform in federal waters in the Arctic. Several similar developments are already operating in state waters. Hilcorp wants to build an artificial gravel island 5 miles off the coast in the Beaufort Sea near Prudhoe Bay. Oil would be carried to shore in a pipeline buried under the seafloor. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management released a draft environmental review of the project today. The agency will take public comments on the proposal through mid-November. Several environmental groups have already spoken out against the project, citing a months-long gas leak from one of Hilcorp's fuel lines in Cook Inlet this spring. From Arctic offshore, we go to Arctic onshore. The National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, is a region in the Arctic bigger than many U.S. states. But it's flown under the radar for years. Unlike a different chunk of federal land located to the east, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Now, that's likely to change. A series of promising oil discoveries and a recent move by the Trump administration mean this vast, remote area is about to get a lot more controversial. Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Desk has the story.
Today, Melanie Smith with Audubon Alaska is teaching me a little bird language.
I think he's saying, stay away from my nest. So this is the yodel call of a yellow-billed loon.
Unfortunately, Smith and I are not birdwatching out in the wilderness. We're listening to recordings in her Anchorage office. That's because the place we're talking about, where we might find a nesting yellow-billed loon and many other bird species from all over the world, is over 600 miles to the north. It's a remote, Indiana-sized federal area in the Arctic called the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, or NPRA.
It's a somewhat unfortunate name, actually, Petroleum Reserve.
But in the 1920s, President Warren G. Harding set aside NPRA specifically for its oil potential. Today, the federal government manages the reserve as a multiple-use area, a place with room for both habitat and oil drilling.
That's why it took longer to discover just how important and influential and irreplaceable parts of the petroleum reserve are, and really realize that they are on par with the Arctic Refuge.
That's right. Smith says on par with the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The areas have different federal designations, but ecologically, well, birds can't tell the difference. Smith says a giant lake in the northeast corner of the reserve, called Teshikpuk Lake, is a globally significant area for hundreds of thousands of migratory birds. That's why, in 2013, the Obama administration put close to half the reserve off limits to oil and gas leasing, including more than 3 million acres surrounding Teshikpuk Lake. But a lot has changed since then.
The war on North American energy is now over.
That's Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke at an oil and gas conference in Anchorage this May. He was in town to sign an order that, among other things, requires a review of the Obama administration's plan for managing NPRA.
This order, in effect, makes Alaska open for business.
It wasn't clear exactly what that meant until last week, when the Interior Department sent out a call asking which parts of the reserve should be opened up to oil drilling. Environmental groups were alarmed because the request made it clear that areas the Obama administration protected could be back on the table. But the move didn't come out of nowhere. Andy Mack is head of Alaska's Department of Natural Resources. He says reevaluating the plan makes sense because we know things now we didn't know 4 years ago.
It couldn't be a more dramatic shift.
It turns out there's a lot more oil in the reserve than everyone thought, even as recently as 2013. Over the last year or so, there have been a series of huge oil discoveries in and around the reserve. Mack says the promise of NPRA is a big deal for a state grappling with both a recession and a steady decline in oil production.
This is certainly some of the most exciting well results that we've seen, and it really is something that we as a state have to appreciate and understand and capitalize on.
The discoveries came on the heels of the first ever oil development in NPRA, a drill site run by ConocoPhillips. That started producing oil in 2015, and two more are on the way. And this could be just the beginning, according to David Hausnecht, one of the U.S. Geological Survey's top experts on Alaska's oil resources.
There's a lot of potential in all of northeastern NPRA for the kind of discoveries that have just been announced.
But it just so happens that the area with the most oil potential overlaps with the same area that environmentalists say is crucial wildlife habitat. Nicole Whittington Evans with the Wilderness Society says the recent oil finds, plus the Trump administration's executive order opening Alaska for business, have groups like hers on high alert.
We have a strong desire to see this area protected, and we are very concerned about the recent finds and the level of interest in drilling for oil in this extremely important place.
If the Trump administration moves to allow oil exploration near NPRA's Teshikpuk Lake, environmental groups are going to fight it, just as they fought development in the Arctic Refuge for decades. The question is, will a place called a petroleum reserve capture hearts and minds as easily as the Arctic Refuge? For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, looking at how people used to make sense of the solar eclipse.
And so these events were still this awe-inspiring, what's happening, we didn't know this was going to happen today event.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
4 out of 5 Alaskans addicted to heroin started by using prescription opioids. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents anyone from taking them without permission, which could endanger them and lead to consequences with law enforcement. Find out more at opioids.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Alaska state troopers say they've charged several inmates at Fairbanks Correctional Center with rioting and assault for their roles in a disturbance reported at about noon today. Captain Ron Wall, who heads up the troopers' Fairbanks-based D detachment, said no serious injuries were reported and no escapes or other security breaches occurred during the incident, which was resolved peacefully after about an hour and a half. Wall says the incident, which authorities are calling a disturbance, occurred in the jail's A wing. Troopers and Fairbanks police sent their SWAT-style special emergency response teams to the jail after receiving a report of the incident. They shut down Wilbur Street, which leads to the facility, for about an hour and 45 minutes. Wall said, quote, "The situation is under control. All personnel have been secured, and the investigation is now continuing because there will be numerous charges." The Fairbanks Daily News Miner reports that while Wilbur was closed, two ambulances drove into the jail parking lot. But Wall told a reporter he wasn't aware of any significant injuries to inmates or correctional officers, and he knew there weren't any injuries to police or troopers. An investigation into the disturbance continues. After 75 days in the shipyard, Southwest Alaska's ferry is finally back in the water. The MV Testamina returned to service this week following repairs that canceled 70% of its summer sailings. While the vessel gets underway, funds for its replacement aren't far behind. The Alaska legislature approved the money to replace the 53-year-old ferry, according to Ora Landau of the Alaska Marine Highway.
This allows the work to start and takes what we know the system needs and the communities need and makes it into a physical reality of a boat that can come up and down the chain.
The cost of building a new vessel is $244 million. The federal government will cover the bulk of that, while the state pays for 10%. Landau says the Marine Highway wants to open the project to construction bids by next winter and have the new ferry ready within 5 years. Until then, the Tustamina will make 3 trips over the remainder of this season. She's scheduled to arrive in Unalaska on August 26th. In the Pribilof Islands, no one's gotten an accurate count of blue king crab since the population crashed hard in the 1980s. This summer, a marine biologist is trying to change that, with the species' first in-depth study in more than 30 years. His ultimate goal, determine if blue crab can make a comeback or if it's gone for good. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Laura Craigle has more.
It's a foggy day on St. Paul Island, and Jared Weems is itching for the weather to clear up. He wants to get out on the water and back to work.
There's so much life up here in the North Pacific. Just amazing, spectacular diving. There's just
Weems is a scientific diver and a fisheries PhD student at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. But this summer, whenever the weather's good, he's something like a diving detective. His research has him combing the seafloor around St. Paul, searching for the elusive blue king crab. By diving in nearshore waters, deploying drop cameras, and setting collector traps, he's hoping to find crab that sweeping trawl surveys tend to miss. And at this point, Weems says it's important to count as many as possible, because the species' outlook seems pretty bleak.
Blue crab is pretty much flatlined right now in the Pribilof regions.
But he says the population around St. Matthew Island, a few hundred miles north, had a similar collapse before rebounding enough to support a handful of commercial openings in recent years. Is that a sign the Pribilof stock could also recover? Weems isn't sure yet. He'll have a better idea after he completes his population estimate, when he knows how many crab are in the water, how many are surviving to adulthood, and how much habitat they have to work with. With that data, he'll gauge if the blue crab population can rebuild naturally, if it needs some help from scientists.
Or if maybe we did overfish them and there's just not enough stock to rebuild.
Whatever the final answer may be, Weems says now is the time to take advantage of each clear day.
Might be one of the last opportunities to really understand this stock before we have to move on or before it's gone completely. So this is really should serve as a foundational study as to where blue king crab goes in the future.
The preliminary results will be out in January, with final data released in 2019. In St. Paul, I'm Laura Craigle.
What kind of threat do invasive crayfish in Alaska pose to subsistence resources? That's a question the Shunack tribe won a grant to study. The money was announced Tuesday. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche reports.
Tribal biologist Kelly Kruger says Shunack applied for a tribal wildlife grant through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service about a year ago. Now the group will get almost $200,000 in funds as part of a continued effort to study crayfish in the Buskin River watershed. Kruger says signal crayfish are from the Pacific Northwest, but have been in the watershed for at least 20 years.
We're not sure how they got here or even how long they've been here, but the population is breeding and we're worried about the subsistence resources and the fish that we all rely on and how the crayfish are impacting those resources.
Kruger says part of the 2-year project includes diving down and collecting crayfish for study, and then coming back to the spot a month later to see how many of the animals have repopulated. They'll also follow the individual crustaceans remotely.
We're going to be attaching these little pit tags. They use them for tracking salmon and other fish, but we're going to be putting them in the crayfish to see where they're moving, so we can see if they're going down to the bottom of the lake or if they're moving out into the river.
They also want to know what the crayfish feed on.
So are they eating dead salmon carcasses? Are they eating salmon eggs? Are they just eating insects? We don't know.
The goal is ultimately to better understand what threat the relatively recent crawfish population poses to the species people have relied on for subsistence for thousands of years. The other two Alaska-based tribal wildlife grant recipients are St. Paul Island for sustainable reindeer management and the Sitka Tribe of Alaska for shellfish population and habitat research in Southeast. In Kodiak, I'm Kayla DeRoche.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
4 out of 5 Alaskans addicted to heroin started by using prescription opioids. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents anyone from taking them without permission, which could endanger them and lead to consequences with law enforcement. Find out more at opioids.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This Monday, August 21st, states across the lower 48 will get to see a full solar eclipse as the moon slides directly in front of the sun for 2 minutes. Alaska Public Media's Henry Leisha spoke with Dr. Aaron Hicks, who's in charge of the University of Alaska Anchorage's planetarium, to learn more about this cosmic event and what we can expect to see in Alaska.
Solar eclipses are an exciting event for stargazers around the globe, but it hasn't always been that way.
In the science circles, we understood what an eclipse was.
Although eclipses have been observed for millennia, Hicks says that until recently, they were generally a terrifying shock to the public.
But in the general population, you know, in the late 1800s even, that information hadn't disseminated out to be common knowledge. And so these events were still this awe-inspiring, what's happening, we didn't know this was going to happen today event.
The last time a solar eclipse happened above the United States like this was in 1878. In his new book, American Eclipse, author David Barron describes how some farmers who didn't know it was coming believed they were seeing the second coming of Christ. Many cultures developed mythological explanations for eclipses. For example, in ancient China, people believed the sun was being devoured by a giant dragon, and the only way to scare it away was to make as much noise as possible. Hicks believes that even with more scientific understanding, the fascination with this phenomenon has not been lost.
I think it's still that awe-inspiring event. It's a time where it brings communities together, reminds us that we all live on this one planet, and that we're part of something much bigger in the universe.
Between Oregon and South Carolina, there's a 70-mile-wide strip of land where the sun will be completely covered by the moon as it passes across the sky. This area is ominously called the Path of Totality. Here, not only will it seem like day has turned to night, but viewers will be able to see parts of the sun that normally can't be observed by the naked eye.
There's this atmosphere of the sun called the corona that we don't see because the primary disk of the sun is very, very bright. But once that disk is blocked out, we can then see kind of this, it's often referred to as kind of a ring of fire, this kind of hazy light up there.
Unfortunately, Alaska is hundreds of miles north of the Path of Totality. But that doesn't mean there won't be any observable effects of the eclipse here. Depending on where you are, a portion of the sun will be blocked. In Anchorage, it'll be a little under half. In Juneau, just over half. In Utqiagvik, less than a quarter. The eclipse will reach its maximum coverage of the sun between 9 and 9:30 a.m. Although a portion of the sun will be obscured, even still, it's important not to stare directly into the sun while viewing the eclipse. The Museum of Anchorage will be hosting a viewing party on the museum's front lawn at 8:30 a.m. on Monday, with solar telescopes and other eclipse viewing equipment. In Anchorage, I'm Henry Leisha.
Earlier this month, a Juneau chef competed in the Great American Seafood Cook-Off. Lionel Udipa of the restaurant Salt showcased Alaska's seasonal foods in the national contest and took inspiration from his Filipino heritage with a king crab risotto dish. KTOO's Annie Bartholomew caught up with the humble new king of cooking seafood.
In a hotel room in New Orleans, ahead of a national seafood cook-off, a pair of Juneau chefs were sweating.
We were having technical difficulties with it the night before because the rice wasn't cooking the way we wanted it to. Our stock didn't taste how we wanted it to. And so kind of going into it, we're, not going to lie, pretty nervous.
The rice is a key ingredient in one of Chef Lionel Udipa's contest recipes. He calls it a lifestyle dish, a comfort food combining aspects from both sous chef Jacob Picard's Italian heritage and his own Filipino roots.
We eat rice 3 times a day, and we just didn't want to scoop rice onto a plate. We wanted to give it some character and, you know, make it as comforting as possible. So that's why we went with the risotto.
Together, the chefs went through a dozen variations before settling on a plate that represented the seasonality of Alaska's fisheries. Alder smoked Bristol Bay king crab, skewered with blueberry branches from Eagle Crest. and the risotto, garnished with sea asparagus, foraged with their toddlers. They stayed up until 2:30 in the morning, workshopping their dishes, tweaking the vanilla ratio, counting out salmon roe, and practicing their presentation. In front of television cameras and a live audience the following day, they only had 60 minutes to prepare 7 plates. Timing was key.
For a hot sec, my rice wasn't cooking as fast as I wanted it to. 5 minutes felt like 30 seconds.
All right, you guys ready for this? Yes. First place in the Great American Seafood Cook-Off is going to Alaska! Yes. Chef Lionel Udipa!
Yes. Back in Juneau, outside the restaurant Salt, Udipa runs into another Juneau-famous chef, 10-year-old Denali Shivens, who cooked his way to the White House and competed on Food Network's Chopped Junior.
I don't think it really got to his head. I saw his face when he won, and it was happy, but it wasn't I'm the best, no one's better than me face.
The pair have been cooking together since Denali was 8. He considers Udipa his mentor. Like Denali, Udipa grew up around food, helping out his aunt who owned Valley Restaurant.
My cousins and my siblings, we'd run around in the apartment building upstairs. So when they got busy, we would just get a phone call from like my mom or my aunt, and they'd be like, hey, we need help. We need you to come here and polish silverware, wash some dishes. And we were always so stoked to do it.
His advice for aspiring chefs like Denali?
Be humble and just be willing to learn.
Udipa says he still polishes silverware, helping out wherever he's needed. His teamwork with Picard and creative spirit continues in Salt's hot and humid kitchen. Bacon lardon sizzles as Picard slices grapefruit. It's for tonight's scallop special.
It's going to be a salad made out of shaved Brussels sprouts and zucchini with a grapefruit vinaigrette and champagne with whipped mascarpone and honey.
They've only been cooking together for 8 months. But long before the contest, Picard started making their winning risotto's signature ingredient, a black cod fish sauce stored in a downstairs prep kitchen. Picard says the fish sauce adds another layer of salty, ocean-like umami taste. In Juneau, I'm Annie Bartholomew.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Avery Lill in Dillingham, Elizabeth Harbaugh, Ann Hillman, and Henry Leisha in Anchorage, Barrett Wilbur and Laura Craigle in Unalaska, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, and Annie Bartholomew in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. The show was produced tonight by Zachariah Hughes, and I'm Rachel Waldholtz. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Opioids are powerful prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication protects children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.